You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Today, we're re-airing some of our favorite recent interviews about American history and politics. And we're starting with a conversation about the real Green Book. The film Green Book caused some controversy when it won the award for Best Picture at the 2019 Oscars. It was the first time many white Americans had ever heard about the Traveler's Guide for Black Americans that was in circulation from 1936 until 1966. It featured establishments all across the country that welcomed black travelers. And although the film took home many awards, it was and is controversial for a lot of reasons, but largely because it was about black lives not told from the perspective of a black person. So if the movie treatment is all you know about the Green Book, then what you're missing is its importance and cultural significance. The Green Book was much more than suggestions on where to eat and sleep. It could be quite literally a lifeline. The guide's tagline was, quote, "Carry your Green Book with you. You may need it." The 1949 edition of the guide stated, "There will be a day sometime in the near future when this guide will not have to be published. That is when we as a race will have equal opportunities and privileges in the United States. It will be a great day for us to suspend this publication, for then we can go wherever we please and without embarrassment. But until that time comes, we shall continue to publish this information for your convenience each year." So what happened to all those locations and businesses featured in the Green Book? Author and photographer Candace C. Taylor answers that question in her new book, Overground Railroad, The Green Book and the Roots of Black Travel in America. She drove across the country visiting and photographing Green Book locations. Candace Taylor joined me in the WNYC studio, and I began by asking her about the book's namesake, Victor Green.
Victor Green was an incredible man. He was a postal worker out of Harlem, and he was an innovator. He was a creator. He decided that there was a need for something, and he made it. He was the publisher, and in the beginning, he did everything. He found all the places. He was from Harlem. It was kind of a one-man show. But his wife, Alma Duke Green, was also his comrade in this journey of producing the Green Book.
And they sort of lived up in Sugar Hill area?
Yes, they did. Yes, and they were fabulous.
When you say fabulous, what do you mean?
Oh, they just had an air about them. You know, they just were very classy people. They dressed nice all the time. They had a beautiful lived in a big building mm-hmm. that had his brother-in-law lived with him, who was a musician, who was very established. And they were just striking, always tall and well-dressed and well-put-together. And Duke Ellington lived catty corner across the street, and they just had a certain Harlem vibe that was really special and dignified.
What was the original vision for the Green Book, and then how did it start to evolve?
Well, Victor Green, you know, like I said, he had his brother-in-law, who's a musician, living with him, and this was Alma's brother. Mm-hmm. And they must have heard so many stories about musicians traveling across the country and running into all kinds of issues with where am I going to stay, or can I eat in the back, or, you know, mm-hmm. where am I going to... And so that was an ongoing issue, which, you know, I'm sure Victor was thinking, well, that's odd that, you know, we don't really have a solution to this. He had a Jewish friend who would go up to the Borscht Belt in the 30s, and he had a traveler's guide for kosher food, and so Victor thought, well, that's really a good idea.
Smart. You know,
we probably need something like that. And then he would drive Alma, his wife, to Richmond, Virginia, regularly. So driving to Virginia regularly would make you think, you know, this may be easier if I knew where to go and where to stay.
Especially when you're driving into the capital of the Confederacy.
Exactly. So I think those three things, you know, really influenced Victor Green's, you know, concept, the idea, what it could be. It started just in Harlem in 1936. It was a very small guide. It was only about 10 pages. No one has actually seen a copy of that. The first guide that we have access to is the 1937 edition, and that expanded into Westchester County, but it was primarily Harlem and Westchester County.
And it's really funny. If you go to the New York Public Library archives, you can pull up images of some of the Green Books. It's for people.
Thank God. The right? Schomburg, right? Thank God, because I would not have a project had I without the Schomburg. And that's the truth. I was a fellow there in 2016, which heavily influenced my research. It just gave me so much more access. When I first started this project in 2013, Wikipedia said there were 1,500 Green Book sites. And because we only had two editions to really go on, it was still kind of a new idea in academia. Mm-hmm. It had been, a few people knew about it, but most people didn't know what the Green Book was when I started doing this project. And when I went to the Schomburg, they had 23 editions at the time of Green Books. And I've cataloged, I started a database. It's taken me years to finish. But once I finished, I found there were nearly 10,000 Green Book sites. Mm. So Wikipedia is saying 1,500. I mean, we just didn't know. And like I said, without the Schomburg, we still wouldn't know.
My guest is Candace Taylor. The name of her book is Overground Railroad. That's a good title. The Green Book and the Roots of Black Travel in America. And to get us, the reader, oriented into what it was like to be a black traveler in America, you start the book with a gentleman named Ron. Mm-hmm. And to sort of explain to us what it was like and why the Green Book was needed, Ron always had a chauffeur's cap in the back of his car. Why was that?
Well, Ron was my stepfather, and he was a black man, dark-skinned black man who grew up in the South during Jim Crow in Tennessee. And the story is, when I was doing this research, I would read a lot of different experiences and stories that people had when they were driving. And I'd always read about the chauffeur's cap that black men used as a ruse or prop to explain, especially if they had a nicer car, because if they were pulled over by law enforcement, if they had a nicer car than an average police officer could afford, there could be vengeance, you know, at the very least harassment. So it was never a good thing. So a lot of times they would say, oh, you know, this is I'm a chauffeur, this isn't my car. And so I asked Ron one day, my stepfather, I said, well, you know, I read this story, is it true? And the story tumbles out of his mouth. I've known this man most of my life, never told me this story, but he, at the age of 7, was in the backseat of the car with his father. Both of his parents were in the front seat. They were heading north. They were taking a short vacation. They get pulled over by the sheriff. The sheriff comes to the side of the door and says, you know, who are these people with you? Whose car is this? Because he had a nice car. He had a good job with the railroad. And Ron's father had looked to Ron right before the sheriff was walking up to the door and just said, don't say a word. And Ron had never heard his father talk to him in that tone or that seriousness. Mm-hmm. He didn't quite understand. He was 7. So when the officer's, you know, asking whose car is this, his father says, this is my employer's car. He turned to his wife, looked at her, pretended he didn't know her, said, this is the maid, and I'm taking her son home, who's sitting in the back. And the officer said, you know, well, where's your hat? And Ron's father said, it's hanging right in the back, officer. And Ron said that hat had been hanging there ever since he could remember, but he never knew what it was or why. And ever since that day, nearly every black man's car he sat in had one. And so that was just, you know, a chilling moment for me, because when you sit in the archives, mm-hmm. and you read and read and research, and then you find even within your own family, there's this tangible evidence, a story. It was how I decided to open the book.
Why was economic prosperity for African Americans considered so threatening?
Well, you know, because I think it's one of the most important themes that runs through my book, and it's one of the most interesting discoveries I made doing this research.
Absolutely.
Because when I found that there were about 70,000 black-owned businesses around this time, and you look at these communities that were mostly African-American communities where Green Book sites were clustered, it was the tool, the very symbol of self-sufficiency. And the fact that black people could run their own businesses, prosper at their own businesses, I mean, the Green Book was like almost like a yellow pages for black businesses. And when you think that, that's kind of the double-edged sword of integration, right? It's the fact that there was so much separation, black folks had to do this out of necessity. But when they did it with such grace and dignity and prosperity. And when you look at Tulsa, you see that is the ultimate example of what could be done, the fact that there were so many successful men and women running those businesses. And I found that in the Green Book, a lot of women ran businesses.
Yeah, that was so interesting. You write in the book that it was critical, that it was critical to women. Here it is. The Green Book played a critical role in the lives of women. Mm-hmm. How so?
Well, I dedicate a whole chapter to it because not only did they run businesses, they ran the Green Book. They were the majority, nearly, as far as we can tell, at least seven of the eight. There's one person on staff of the Green Book that had initials as the first name. So I don't know if they were male or female, but everybody else there was female except for Victor Green. And so not only women were at the forefront of editing these, there were many, many articles that were published in the Green Book. There was, as I mentioned, Alma, Victor's wife, she was there from the beginning. He dies in 1960, so he never lives to see the passage of the Civil Rights Movement, really, or the passage of that act. And Alma takes over. So she's publisher, she's editor. Novara Deschel, she's a big major player in the Green Book and edits a lot of the articles. So not only did they run businesses, they ran the Green Book, and in many ways were not, there was never any real threat or attention. It never, you know, when I look at back at the articles of all these Green Book sites with these women running it, there was never like, oh, there's a woman running it. It was never really even made into anything that we need to take note of. But I think when you look back at how gender and race plays a role in who owns businesses and who's deciding things, mm-hmm. it was remarkable to me to see, because when you compare how many people own black businesses then to now, it's a fraction. It's a within probably single-digit percentages, you know, of how many people. It's stunning. So I think that it was a really resourceful, innovative time for black folks. I think that if you walk away from my major focus of, you know, thinking about this book and what I want people to walk away from is knowing that we didn't need white folks to give us capital to make something important. And Victor Green didn't need permission or white capitalism to create something that was such a force for change and access in this country. And so I think the lens on how we look outward to create something for ourselves, we already have this in us. We've already done this. And there were so many more incredible odds against folks back then, right? So to me, that was a really hopeful message, and just in how empowering we are, how innovative we are as a people, and how something so simple could be so powerful.
You're listening to my conversation with Candace Taylor about her book, Overground Railroad, The Green Book and the Roots of Black Travel in America. We'll continue our conversation with Candace Taylor about the Overground Railroad after a quick break. You're listening to All of It. Welcome back to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. We're listening to my conversation with Candace Taylor about her book, Overground Railroad, The Green Book and the Roots of Black Travel in America. I asked Candace about her own travels across the country while researching this book and how she decided where to go and which routes to take.
Well, it's been a long, long process. Your producer, when we were walking in here, she said, I looked at your bio and there were so many different places that you've lived. I couldn't, you know. And I live in Harlem now, but I've moved about eight times in this process of writing the book. And part of it is, you know, I did the fellowship at Schomburg. So I was living in Los Angeles when I started the project. And then I moved to New York to do the Schomburg Fellowship. And so I took a big trip on my way there. I visited about 900 Green Book sites. And then I went to a fellowship at Harvard. After Harvard was when I just really hit the road for many months at a time, and my things were in storage for years, and I just literally lived on the road out of my car for a good, I don't know, it was almost 2 years for that. I settled in Bisbee for a while. But each time I took a trip, if I was on a trip for like 5 months, I got it down to where I could scout about 30 sites a day. because there were so, and I was working 16-hour days. My family and friends were not happy about my how rigorous. You know, I just didn't stop. But I knew that if I didn't get at least a good sampling, there were nearly 10,000 Green Book sites. So I've scouted over 4,000 at this point. But I knew I had to get a snapshot of really what the statistical evidence is around how many of them are actually still here, mm-hmm. How many are standing versus how many are in business. And I discovered that about 3% roughly are still in business. About 80% of them are gone. And when I left Harvard, you know, of course I loved just sitting in archives and reading and researching, but I knew that that was only part of the story because getting to, into these communities, seeing what happened to these communities, whether they're just gone, redlining, you know, played obviously a huge role in the segregation of these communities, but also urban renewal. And sometimes I'd go and there'd just be a freeway taking up where 20 Green Book sites were once were, right? So, you know, seeing the physical kind of evidence, the tangible evidence of these government policies that shaped these communities, and also seeing what policies we're using that are in effect now, such as mass incarceration, things that are happening now that have put an indelible scar on what these places look like, how they function. And when you think of, you know, I was in Chicago and there 53 people had been shot that weekend.
You write in the book it was the only place that you were frightened. It was truly frightened.
Truly, I mean, yeah. Miami was another one where I just was, I left early because my instincts told me this isn't good. You know, I need to leave. And Ron, my stepfather, was in law enforcement. He was also a Marine, so he had taught me how to use, you know, a knife, and I traveled with a stun gun. I was physically lunged at, nearly attacked. I mean, so there were major cities where things were not good, but the kind of looming where I just, in Chicago, I thought, I'm afraid to even get out of my car to go to the restroom. And isn't that ironic? Because I'm doing research on a guide that was published.
Meant for safety.
Yeah, for safety for Black folks that was published, you know, 70 years ago. So that was a real also conundrum of, you know, that's why it was so important for me to not just write about the Green Book in the context of what this was as an historic time capsule, because how it relates to today and what it says about who we are as a culture and what we believe in, especially as a country, in that fight for equality and the symbolism that we so want to attach ourselves to is in conflict. And it was so apparent to me, like I said, when I'm sitting there afraid to get out of my car or mm-hmm. thinking, do I take my camera with me? Where do I put it? If the car's not here when I come back, what does that mean? You know, all of those questions. So it was eye-opening. I'm so glad that I spent so much time on the road.
And you took beautiful photographs.
That's
one of the great things. I often write in books when I'm researching a guest. I couldn't write in your book.
Oh,
the paper is beautiful, and the photos are so beautiful. I was like, I can't write in this book. I'm interested in two questions. The first, you know, we talked about safety, and one of the things the Green Book did was it let people know which towns were sundown towns where you had to be out by sundown.
Actually, it didn't.
It didn't.
No, the Green Book didn't, and that's what was interesting is. It wasn't that example of, you know, this is dangerous or we have to be careful. There were some ominous, you know, carry this, you may need it.
Yeah.
But there was no mention of sundown towns in the Green Book. And I found out through sundown towns through James Lowen's book, Sundown Towns. So obviously there was no internet. There was no way for Black folks to know where.
You know, would they get information from people? I mean, would that be the kind of thing
was
where
word
people
of mouth.
On the way?
It was definitely
you'd
word
have
of
to
mouth.
Know.
Yeah. And I think people, especially people who were migrating from the South, that was a big tool, the reason why people used the Green Book. They'd be leaving, and I'm sure there were always, like, make sure when you pass through such and such, you know, or don't, make sure you sleep here, get gas there, because when you drive through this. But I don't even think the term sundown town was a thing then.
It was just things somebody told somebody.
People yeah, and there were other signs that said, you know, N-word, don't let the sun set on you here. Or, you know, that some towns would ring a bell at 6 p.m. alerting the local help mm-hmm. to leave. But you know, it wasn't until James Lowen wrote the book that I think it coined the term and the idea. And he found that there were thousands of these towns throughout the country.
When you got to certain towns, there's this great passage you write about New Orleans specifically. And you write, the Green Book article on New Orleans is unlike most travel articles. Some of the pieces cover the beautiful wrought iron balconies and quaint courtyards that could be found in the French Quarter, but it also highlights the importance of the levees in a city surrounded by swamps. the paragraph goes on. Obviously, because we're talking about what happened in New Orleans. How prescient was the Green Book? What are things that are happening today?
Well, that's, you know, we just seem to fail to, you know, learn from our past, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why, again, it was so important to me to not write a book that only focused on looking at the past, and because people would say, when I tell them about the Green Book, they say, oh, thank God we don't need that anymore. And it's like, well, we have no Airbnb, we have all these, you know, black travel, mm-hmm. The home share, you know, companies popping up because there is a need again. Mm-hmm. And I think that if anything, the Green Book teaches us is that there are these familiar patterns that we keep playing out. And I think part of it, you know, as I wrote the book, I had written the whole book without putting the more present analysis on where we are now. And then after I finished writing the book, I told my agent, I said, I think I got to put all this stuff in throughout the book. And so it was like a puzzle that I had completed and I had to tear it apart. And I was at my wit's end. I was like, oh my God, how am I going to do this and finish it in time? But I think that was so important to put that layer of, you know, moments like that when you read that passage in New Orleans, because that can trigger the, you know, the levees, they did break, right? And Katrina happened. And then we see the Green Book sites there that had to deal with Katrina that we lost, and the ones that are still standing, like Leah Chase's, you know, Chase Dookie Chase's restaurant. So that is all to say, I think that if there are things that will seem incredibly obvious that, oh, that sounds very familiar in the book, and then there's direct access to me pointing to specific policies like mass incarceration, things that will that have direct influence on how these communities have managed to survive despite all of these social forces. And I think that's a story that we keep running against. And until we really decide to tell the truth about why certain policies are made or, mm-hmm. you know, the real strength in pushing back and making sure our elected officials are held accountable for these things, we will continue to do this for the next 100 years.
I'm curious, of the places that did survive, as opposed to the ones that didn't survive, was there something special that happened? Was it luck? Was it politics? The ones that did survive, what was unique about them that they survived and other ones didn't? Could you figure that out?
I think it was all the above, but really, you know, when I got a grant from the Library of Congress to interview these business owners. And so when I went and talked to them about the ones that, especially these family businesses that managed to stay in play, like Dookie Chase's restaurant, mm-hmm. I interviewed Leah before she passed, which was a huge honor. And I interviewed people like Sweat's, David Sweat. He ran Sweat's restaurant in Nashville. And he said from the beginning he catered to, it was an integrated audience, and a lot of the white folks there remembered in the South, like, this was what their maids cooked for them. This was the food they grew up on, and they couldn't find it in white restaurants, so they went to Sweat's, which, you know, and he's still a bustling, really popular restaurant. But I don't think that, you know, the reason why we lost a lot of the Green Book sites, like I said, were through urban renewal. They were just literally bulldozed down. Mm-hmm. Didn't matter how popular they were all of a sudden gone. And the ones that really had, there's Gates Barbecue, too, in Kansas City. When I interviewed Ollie Gates, you know, they just were more flexible with the times and could grow in a way that, you know, and again, I don't think it's just that. There were so many other factors of the love. They had had 5 or 6 different restaurants in Kansas City, so they were a staple in the community. So there's these businesses that just had a real stronghold on their mm-hmm. community. But I don't, you know, when we lost them, it was mostly because when integration happened, say, for instance, if you could never go to the French Quarter as a black person, all of a sudden you can go to the French Quarter, places like the Dewdrop that is still standing but not operating. All those people left. And sadly, you know, there's a great quote by a woman who was talking about the Hampton House in Miami. She said, you know, we got what we wanted mm-hmm. in terms of integration, but we lost what we had.
Where could you point to us to a couple of Green Book sites in New York if people think, I want to go see one, I want to go be part of it, I want to go feel it?
Yes. Well, New York is special because Harlem, Victor Green was from here. Mm-hmm. It has the most Green Book sites than anywhere else in the country. There were over 400 of them just in Harlem. There were 268 below 110th Street. Sadly, most of the ones in Harlem are gone. But if you go to 135th Street, right down the street from the Schomburg, and Adam Clayton Powell, there's an IHOP there. But above that IHOP was where Victor Green's office was. So that's fun. And then across the street, you'll see a neon sign called Fane Hotel. The hotel is gone, but the sign is still there. That was a Green Book site. The YMCA down the street on 135th, that was a Green Book site. So I would start there because then you're right at the Schomburg and it's perfect, you know. But there were also, the Green Book also had a lot of larger, more white-owned businesses as well. So Macy's was in the Green Book. The Algonquin was in the Green Book. Pierre Hotel was in the Green Book. So there's all these places in Midtown, too, that are still here with us. That are good to visit, too, and see that history.
That was my conversation with Candace Taylor about her book, Overground Railroad, The Green Book and the Roots of Black Travel in America. Coming up, my conversation with veteran New York Times reporter and author Jennifer Steinhauer about her book, The Firsts, The Inside Story of the Women Reshaping Congress.